This is the Heartland Daily Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the illiterate. Oh, nope. sorry, force of habit there. This is not the illiteracy podcast. This is just the regular old Heartland Daily Podcast. See, I told you that spider has me all screwed up. Anyway, I'm Tim Benson, Senior Policy Analyst at the Heartland Institute, a national free market think tank, and I'm doing some pinch hitting today on the regular old Heartland Daily Podcast with this one little special episode today of this podcast. So we'll get into that in a second. But yeah, if you like this podcast, please consider giving the Heartland Daily Podcast a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this show, and also by sharing with your friends, as that's the best way to support programming like this. And my guest today, our guest today, is Jonathan Butcher, the Will Skillman Fellow in Education at the Heritage Foundation and the author of Splintered: Critical Race Theory and the Progressive War on Truth. But he's not here to talk about his book, which we've already done a little while ago, and which is great, and you should go out and buy it if you already haven't, and give it a read if you already haven't. But he's here today to talk about Heritage's new Education Freedom Report Card. So, Jonathan, well, first of all, thanks for coming back on again. I appreciate it. Why don't you tell everybody just exactly what is the Education Freedom Report Card? What was the impetus behind it? And what's the purpose of the report, the goal of the report card?
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's a pleasure to be here. Our report card is meant to be a resource that's a model, right? It's meant to be an example for state lawmakers who are looking to give more students in their states access to a quality learning option. And so we provide not only an analysis of what's happening in states around the U.S. in terms of their policies for assigned public schools, as well as private schools and homeschooling, but also education spending and transparency and models, right? Model legislation, ideas and analysis about what is happening with the way that assigned public schools are operating, so that state lawmakers can say, hey, look, I mean, we want students to have a great learning opportunity, especially coming out of COVID and with all of the, frankly, dismal news that we are hearing about student achievement right now. We have, created this as a resource so that lawmakers have a place to go, right, as they look towards especially the next legislative session.
Yeah. How long did it take you guys to put it together?
I mean, we've spent the better part of really the end of last year and through the spring to gather the different data that we put together. And that's, worth explaining, right? I mean, we are not just taking one indicator or looking at one test score and saying, all right, we're going to rank this state based on this one thing. We actually have a variety, actually, of different categories that we use, including school choice, academic transparency, regulation, issues of regulatory freedom or lack thereof, and then spending, or better said, return on investment. Mm-hmm. How are states using taxpayer resources to improve student performance on the most reliable indicators that we have of student achievement? This one is really the nation's report card.
Yeah. Let's get into that methodology for a bit. Like you said, you have these four broad categories with the education choice, regulation, regulatory burden, transparency of the education system, and then spending, return on investment. But there's also, I'm trying to guess just by when I was reading through it, a couple dozen at least of sort of subcategories or that went into each different, regular category. So let's talk about education choice first, and what are at least the most important variables that went into the education choice ranking?
Sure, and school choice was important to our whole report card because we weighted actually the school choice indicators, so that essentially more points were given, right, to states that have very strong parental choice options in education. And that was done on purpose, right? I mean, we feel like that is the change that will really redirect the education landscape in the United States as we know it, right? So that's why we gave it a weighting.
Sure.
Under private school choice, the states who gained points were those that have strong education savings account options, right? So the ones that come to mind, of course, are Florida, which ranked overall number one on our report card, and then followed by Arizona, which actually ranked first in in school choice, right? So Arizona was first in our school choice category. Florida, I believe, ranked third. And so, you know, you have these two states that are really at the top of our report card. We're also at the top of the school choice side. And then, you know, into this calculation, into our algorithm, if you want to call it that, was the proportion of eligible students as well as the proportion of students who are participating. So it's not just do you have a private school choice option, but are students using it? And could more students access it if they wanted to? Right? Mm-hmm. Is it actually creating freedom? We talk about the design of these choice programs. Do they have requirements that make it difficult for private schools to participate? On the side of charter schools, right? We have a ranking for whether or not there is a rating, or where they rank on the National Charter School Ranking and Scorecard for the Center for Education Reform. They, of course, are a great research institute in DC as well. And homeschooling law, we looked at the Homeschool Legal Defense Association and how they rank each state's homeschooling law. So all of that, right, went into eventually the number that came out.
Yeah, and it's not just when you're talking about education choice, you're not obviously you mentioned charters, so you're not talking just about private schools. You're also talking about, you know, public school choice policies, too. You know, whether a state has an open enrollment policy for public schools, you know, the size of the local school districts, you know, and the population, the student population of those districts, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right. And I didn't mention that. I mean, we do have a section of this ranking that deals with an open enrollment policy, whether or not you can choose a different public school, traditional public school on the other side of town, on the other part of the state. And like you were saying, students per district, the size of the district, all of these things went into our component of the public school choice side of our overall school choice ranking.
Mm-hmm. Now, on to the regulatory side, the regulatory burden. What were the variables that went into coming up with that ranking?
Sure. And I think many people may not realize that, you know, the public education systems around the U.S. have a lot of similarities, right, state to state, even though they're all governed by, you know, their own set of state laws. But there are some things, sadly, right, that have become very common and I think have inhibited the ability of assigned district schools really to meet their ultimate goals, which is helping students to succeed in school and in life. So the first part of our regulatory ranking had to do with whether or not competent professionals can leave their job and go into the teaching profession. How hard would it be for Bill Gates to teach computer science? How difficult would it be for an engineer at Honeywell to, you know, go and teach math or physics, right? And many states, you know, actually make it quite difficult to get a teacher certificate. I mean, there's a process of taking a praxis exam sometimes. You have to have hours of student teaching and all of these different things, which, you know, research has found that just because a teacher has a certain certification or even a degree in teaching or, you know, something that is very common in the education workforce in terms of, you know, qualifications, it does not correlate to better outcomes for students, right? So this sort of funnel, if you will, that's been created as students go through college and then into colleges of education and then follow the process on to take the various exams and such to become a teacher, you know, all of that is not necessarily guaranteeing, right, that students, that teachers, excuse me, are going to be ready for what they're going to face in the classroom. So that was one, right? We want a state to have the ability for what is called alternative certification. So that's a big one. The other one, and this is something that's been in the news in recent months, especially last couple of years, is this question of chief diversity officers, which, as my colleague Jay Green and a researcher that he worked with named James Paul, they did a study of large school districts around the country and whether or not they have a staff person whose sole job is to promote this, frankly, very partisan agenda, right? I mean, this question of, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, I mean, this is a political ploy. There is no strong academic basis for what is DEI, yeah. what should be taught. And frankly, I think as many people know, who anyone, right, who's seen the shoutdowns on college campuses, who's seen the material that's being taught in many K-12 systems that promotes, you know, racial identity and gender identity and, you know, these they are identity politics is really what they are. They know that, you know, these CDOs are creating a the very opposite of what is authentically diversity, especially diversity of thought,
yeah.
equity, which really should be equality under the law, and inclusion, which means that no matter what you think, you get to have, you know, your say in a public square, right? So so that's why we gave a lower ranking to the districts or the states that had a lot of chief diversity officers, especially in their large districts. And then finally, for those who can remember the Common Core movement several years ago that really I think was a colossal failure to improve student achievement. And that was what it was sold as, right? Mm-hmm. The Common Core was sold as this sort of take it out of the box, apply it in your school, and it will, you know, raise student success because you have this common set of standards that everybody will be held to. So if you have a requirement that you use a Common Core test in your state, which I would say fortunately is actually becoming less and less likely these days. I think the two tests that were very common under the Common Core are being used less and less. So anyway, points were taken off for those things. So that's kind of a long explanation of how we looked at a state and said, all right, what are the biggest things that we see that are regulations? What are the ways in which bureaucrats are trying to manipulate the way that schools operate and are limiting the choices that families and students have to right. you know, find something that meets their needs.
Gotcha. All right. And then transparency and the ability for parents to make the best decisions about their children's education given off of the information they're provided. What were the variables for the transparency category?
Sure, and I can go through this one faster, I think, than the last. It's also been in the news a lot, right? We've heard a lot about states that are prohibiting compelled speech, right? States that I think are appropriately saying that no student should be forced to affirm something from critical race theory or affirm some idea that violates the Civil Rights Act, right? Like that individuals should be separated according to skin color for different projects. So if a state has a strong law that rejects racial discrimination, especially by way of compelled speech, they were given points for that. Also, the number of organizations, parent organizations available in a state that are defending student rights. Parents Defending Education was one of our sources for this, and I highly recommend those to that organization to everyone who's listening. The number of incidents in K-12 schools dealing with either censorship or racial discrimination by way of something like an affinity group. Points were taken off for states that had higher numbers of those. And then this last one was the big one, and that had to do with whether or not parents have access to what's being taught in schools. And I would call this academic transparency. So it's not just textbooks, it's not just homework, it's all of these things, right? Parents should know what is the reading list, what is in a textbook, right? What are the homework assignments? They should be able to see this material.
Yeah.
So if they have questions or objections, they can take it to a teacher or a school official.
Yeah, it boggles my mind that in so many places, like, you, a parent can't, that, like, what is going to be taught that semester or that quarter in that class is not, you know, is not made available to them to look at for themselves and to see, you know, what the plan is, where the student should be, every day or every week or, you know, what have you. And, you know, just the amount of hand-wringing that comes from unions and others about, you know, making that stuff available to the parents.
Well, and remember, during COVID, when school was online for all students at one point, schools had to do this.
Yeah.
So there's really no excuse now to say suddenly the internet doesn't work in school, right? I mean, that's nonsense. Of course, you can put it on the web so parents can see it. And look, parents know, I mean, they are well aware of programs like Blackboard and Canvas and Schoology, right? These are all programs that are designed for parents to see grades, homework assignments, email a teacher, right? These are all interfaces that have been created for expressly this purpose, right? So parents can have more information.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, and then the final category we get to in the methodology is the spending and return on investment category. Yeah. So again, just sort of the same thing. Just talk about the variables and that made this one up.
Sure. So if the first is obvious, right? We looked at the per student spending for different states. And then we looked at, we adjusted that figure for cost of living, right? To see what it costs in a state given the various prices and things like that and the economic environment in different states. We looked at the average score on the nation's report card compared to what is spent, right? In terms of spending per pupil. We looked at the teacher to non-teacher ratio. I don't know that many people are aware that the ratio of instructional staff, so teachers, to non-instructional staff, i.e. anybody else that works in a school, is about 1-to-1, right? Taxpayers are paying for just as many administrators as they are educators around the country on average. Also, unfunded pension liabilities, which is a big deal for states like Illinois, for example, that have just woeful pension problems. And so all of these things went into not just a question of how much does a state spend, but what are they getting for how much taxpayer money they're using.
Yeah. And that teacher to non-teacher ratio you mentioned, that's something that has ballooned substantially in the last 20 years or so. I mean, we were talking about the DEI administrators earlier. And people don't sort of think about that, but, you know, every dollar that's spent on some administrator, some bureaucrat or, middle management in a school is a dollar that's not, not going to a teacher, or it's not going, into classroom learning. So even though spending may be going up, in state budgets and whatnot, that doesn't necessarily mean that all that money is getting, sent into a classroom.
You're absolutely right. And I think that more states really should be doing what the Arizona Auditor General does. And I've always been impressed. I read a lot from the Arizona Auditor General when I was at the Goldwater Institute some years ago, but they produce an annual report with a look at every school district in the state, how much they spend per student, and then what percent of all of that spending actually goes to classroom expenses and what winds up going to administrators. And it's frankly shocking, right? I mean, there are school districts there that are, spending maybe 50 cents on the dollar, right, actually in the classroom. And so I think that more, and I'm sure that Arizona is not alone, right? I'm sure that there are other states where this is, that's quite common. And, one of the comments that I've seen to our report card is, well, look, you didn't rank, states that are scoring really high in average scores on NAEP. You didn't rank them very high because clearly their students are achieving. So, how come you didn't just rank those states well? And so the answer is, if you look at a state like, I'll pick on Massachusetts, right? The per student spending is pretty high in Massachusetts and taxpayers are paying a lot for a 20-point or more, in some cases, achievement gap between white students and black students, or white students and Hispanic students in certain cases. So just because you have a high average score in a state doesn't mean you're helping every child access a quality learning experience. And for those who don't follow education policy may not realize that there was an active effort to block the growth of charter schools in Boston about 5 or 6 years ago. So, just because you have high average scores for one subset of students doesn't mean that you're helping those children who need it the most, right? We're not looking at average scores, which, you know, are driven by, say, a state that has a high population of, you know, upper class students or students mm-hmm. from different backgrounds. We need an education freedom landscape here, right? Where students, no matter their background, can have access to quality options.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I was just about to ask you about that. You know, for people listening there from, you know, say Massachusetts or New Jersey, which I think are usually like number one, number two, pretty much every couple of years on the NAEP score. That you know, hey, how can we be in the bottom five of these rankings? You know, if our students are performing so well. So I'm glad you brought that up. So, but let's talk about the top five and the bottom five. We've already brought up Florida and Arizona a little bit, and then Massachusetts. So Florida, Arizona, Idaho, Indiana, South Dakota are the top five states in the ranking on the report card, and then the bottom five, starting with the worst to least worst, is the District of Columbia is number 51, New York 50, New Jersey 49, Maryland 48, Massachusetts 47. So obviously you've told us all, you know, what's going into the methodology, and we can pretty much figure out that the bottom five states are doing all of those poorly for the most part, and then the top five states are scoring high across all those categories. But is there anything specifically that those states are doing that are moving them up really, really high or keeping them very, very low?
Well, you know, we mentioned that school choice was mm-hmm. weighted. And so obviously, you know, Florida has an education savings account program. They have the largest private school scholarship program for children from low-income families, by the way, yep. as well as a private school voucher program for children with special needs, as well as a good charter school landscape. So, and an open enrollment law. So it's got all of those things. Same with Arizona. And I would note too that Florida, of course, you know, with under the Governor DeSantis, has worked very hard on this transparency issue and mm-hmm. and issue of allowing, you know, protecting individuals from discrimination and all of these things. So that, you know, that puts Florida up there. I would mention, you know, for state lawmakers who see a state like, let's take South Dakota, they don't rank necessarily very high on school choice or regulatory freedom. But on transparency, they do very well. And that was in part because of an executive order from the governor earlier this year that said no individual should be compelled to affirm any idea that violates the Civil Rights Act. Right. I mean, they took on this question of protecting individuals from discrimination very seriously. Other states such as West Virginia did well on school choice. But I believe that once their education savings account law actually goes into effect, I think that I would expect to see them climb higher. Utah did very well on this issue of spending and return on investment. So they ranked very well there. I would say at the bottom, I mean, look, Washington, D.C. has the nation's only federally funded voucher program. It's for children with special needs, but Congress routinely tries to kill it. Congress or the White House, right?
Yeah.
Routinely tries to kill it every year or almost every year. And so I think that it's really been kept at, you know, somewhere south of 2,000 students. This is something that really should be expanded to give more students, you know, better quality options. They actually do better on school choice than any of their other categories because they have a pretty healthy charter mm-hmm. school sector. Although even there, I think there's always a fight between charter school operators and school and, you know, the school board trying to get access to vacant buildings. So, you know, that's something that's, you know, that's worth looking into. You know, New York, you know, there are districts in New York that were following the Black Lives Matter week of action at schools, you know, guiding principles about, you know, trying to dismantle the nuclear family and, you know, all of these,
yeah.
these kind of radical ideologies. So that's, you know, New York clearly was, I would put them at a place that is, everyone should be, you know, kind of paying attention here to what big districts like New York City are doing on these issues, because many other, I would argue, radical districts with, I would say, radical leaders are going to try to follow. And then, you know, we mentioned Massachusetts and Maryland as, you know, as well. They may do well on average scores on NAEP, for example, but, you know, in Maryland, school districts like Montgomery County are paying, I think it was $500,000 for equity audits. And, you know, there are things being done in school districts in some of these states that are clear examples of taking the focus off of student achievement and putting it on some sort of political agenda.
Mm-hmm. Were there any states that that surprised you with their rankings, good or bad? Was, you know, when you were putting this together, were you like, oh, wow, so-and-so's in the top 20, or oh, wow, you know, so-and-so's in the, you know, the bottom 20? Or was there anything that you expected when you guys were putting this together? Was there any state that you expected to be higher or lower and then turned out not to be?
Yeah, I think my hope is that Texas moves up in the rankings. I think that, you know, Texas has long struggled to create more private school choice options for families. Mm-hmm. I think that they do have a healthy charter school sector, but I think that that's an area in which they could improve, as well as in this issue of transparency. They did enact a provision dealing with, you know, trying to deal with critical race theory last year. However, there's some provisions in there that we need to keep an eye on. They actually talk specifically about banning certain content. Yeah. And I think that that's the wrong way to go, right? I don't think we should be looking for books to ban. We need to, and I've seen others in the conservative movement say this, so this isn't my own, you know, I haven't come up with this concept here, but we're talking about age-appropriate material, right?
Yeah, sure.
The issue here is not, you know, well, we should have, you know, books like, you know, Lawn Boy or other, you know, the Gender Queer, you know, these kinds of things that have been in the headlines. We should have them in libraries, school libraries, otherwise it's not freedom of speech. Well, no, because it's not age appropriate for a second grader to be reading that kind of material, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the responsibility of an educator to be conscious and aware of what is appropriate to expose students to at different times in their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Texas actually, like I said, I'm just looking at their little section of the report card. They ranked overall, you know, fairly high. They're 12th overall in the ranking, but their school choice ranking is pretty low. It's number 35th. And then they don't, as you said, Texas doesn't provide any sort of private school choice options at all. But I know this wasn't part of the rankings or didn't get into it, but did you find any correlation between, say, the strength of the teachers' unions in a particular state and that state's ranking on the report card?
Well, I mean, look, if you look at the bottom 10, I think it's almost, you know, unmistakable, right? I mean, yeah. Illinois is ranked 42, you've got Rhode Island 44, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maryland, New Jersey, New York. I mean, these are all states that have very strong teacher union presence. So I think that I don't think it's just a coincidence. I think that the teachers unions, you know, have helped to drive those. I mean, you know, because we were talking about what happened in Boston a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. with charter schools. Something very similar has happened in Chicago, right? Where the unions helped to block the growth of charter schools in that city. So I think it's clearly not an accident. It's not an accident. I think, you know, I think one of the things that I hope lends credibility to our report card is that as you look through states that, let's say, have a high ranking on different areas. So let's take Missouri, for example, has a pretty good ranking when it comes to school choice, when it comes to regulatory freedom and spending. However, they ranked 51st in transparency.
Yeah.
For the reasons that we've outlined here. Oklahoma, same thing, right? They've got a pretty good school choice ranking, you know, spending, et cetera. But they ranked 46 on transparency. So, you know, we take into account here that states may do something very good on this one, you know, on these one or two areas over here. But that doesn't mean that we can somehow overlook, right? Or not take into consideration what's going wrong, because that, you know, that can create an environment where not every family, again, has the chance to, you know, to pursue success for their student.
Yeah, Missouri specifically, they're in three out of the four categories. They're a top 10 state in their top five in school choice, but that transparency ranking at 51, you know, drops them all the way to you know, 17th overall in the rankings. So, yeah, so that's pretty wild. But one more thing, I guess, before we sort of start wrapping it up. I know you guys did the unveiling or the big sort of
our launch.
Yeah, your grand opening sort of thing in Florida, down here in Orlando, with Governor DeSantis as the keynote speaker, I believe. And have you guys do you know if has anything been signaled from Florida state legislators or the DeSantis from the governor's office about pushing Florida in a direction of a universal ESA like Arizona? You know, Arizona started sort of stole Florida's thunder there this year with that. Has there been any talk about making a push for that before? You know, I have a pretty good feeling that my governor wants to run for a president at some point, maybe sooner rather than later. So, you know, I think for him, it would be, you know, quite the feather in the cap to point to this new latest victory for parents and for children in Florida to have, you know, universal school choice down here.
Well, I think that certainly the school choice advocates in the state are talking about it. And I think one of the things that impresses me about Florida over the past few years is that they, even as they have expanded some eligibility provisions for their, you know, existing catalog, right, of school choice options, they also, I think, responsibly sort of combined programs that didn't need to be standalone programs. So they combined the education savings account with the McKay voucher. They, you know, they're looking for ways, I think, to make these options more accessible and more, I would argue, efficient, right, in terms of operation. So I would hope that Florida and lawmakers in every state, you know, would be looking at these same, you know, at that same goal, right, at that same objective.
All right, cool. So how often are you guys going to update this? Is this going to be like consistently updated, like every time we get a law passed or something like that, or some change in policy, or is it going to just be like a annually, like once a year, you're going to redo the rankings, or how is that going to work?
I believe at this point we're looking to do it every year, and I know that we're already starting the process of updating it for next year. I think that we will be, I believe, adding some components that should make this even more precise. I think there are some things that we see that would help to not necessarily change our calculation, but make the calculation better representative of where states wind up, and hopefully, you know, remove, because look, in any kind of ranking or calculation like that, there's always some subjectivity to it.
Sure.
There's some choices we had to make about good, bad, and that kind of thing. And so I think the more that we can add in variables that make it more precise, I think put a finer point on it, the better for lawmakers, the better tool it becomes, you know, for state policymakers. So yeah, keep an eye on next year, because I think we have some good things that we'll be adding to it to make it even better.
Great, very cool. So all right, is there anything else you want to plug while you're here? Anything going on? Anything coming up you want people to know about?
Well, we're excited for the release of this report card, and I also, you know, part of the rankings here used research that my colleague Jay Green, for one, has done over the past year and a half, looking at, I mean, simply just counting the number of either staff or programs in colleges or K-12 schools that represent this really aggressive radical agenda that is taking the focus off of math and reading and putting it on, you know, identity politics. And I think just knowing what the environment looks like is important. It's important for policymakers and families to be able to recognize, you know, what are we doing here, right? We're at a point where students are struggling. We need to be focusing on getting them, you know, getting them back where they need to be academically, and not some sort of activist, you know, 6-hour school day.
Yeah. Well, my hat's off to all you guys for putting this together. I know how much of a pain in the butt it can be for this stuff. Heartland did a welfare reform report card a few years back, which I wasn't involved in because that's not my topic area, thank God. But I just remember, you know, how much blood, sweat, and tears went into it. And it's a lot to put something like this together. And you guys did a really excellent job with it. excuse me. For those of you out there listening, that's the website where you can reach this, which is heritage.org/education report card. You can go and check it out. It has it all broke down. You can break down, you can just see the states and where they rank by themselves, and just, you know, click on your state and see what it's doing well, what it's not doing well, or, you know, what it needs to improve, that sort of thing. And you can also compare state versus state. There's a tool to do that function. And then again, as you said, you provide the model legislation on there as well, not just from Heritage, but there's also a couple things on there from Goldwater, the Goldwater Institute out in Arizona, and Institute for Justice, IJ, who both do great works. And then again, you can also, you know, check out the methodology of the report and all that sort of stuff. So it's really a nice interactive website. It's a, you know, it's a easy way to lose yourself for for a half an hour or an hour, just you know, clicking around and finding stuff out and you know, seeing stuff. So highly recommend everybody out there, parents especially, legislators especially, check that out and you know, fart around on there for a while and you know, and explore. So and yeah, so everyone check that out. And again, my guest Jonathan Butcher, the Will Skillman Fellow in Education at the Heritage Foundation, thank you again, very, very much for coming on, sort of short notice. I sort of broke this with you last week, so thanks for taking the time out to do this. I appreciate it, as always.
Well, thank you, and anytime.
Yeah, no problem. All right. And again, if you like this podcast, please leave the Heartland Daily Podcast a 5-star review and share with your friends. And for more information about the Heartland Institute, go to heartland.org. Thank you for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time. Take care. Love you, Robbie. Love you, Mom. Bye-bye.